the stars. Every boy in Oliver's grade had crushes on Issa and Jesse. It was disgusting. How about jewelry? Angie suggested, jogging up to Oliver after completing a flawless layup. Girls like that kind of stuff. You never wear jewelry, Oliver pointed out. It gets in the way of basketball, Angie replied with a shrug, spinning the ball on her index finger. Oliver shook his head. I have $2.36 total to spend on my sisters and my parents. His friends winced. Realizing the gravity of the situation, they started rummaging around in their pockets and backpacks for anything they could contribute to the cause. Things got pushed into Oliver's hands. One stick of peppermint gum, 2 dimes and 3 pennies, a beat-up piece of candy, a bright green mechanical pencil with a nubby pink eraser at the end, a strand of plastic gold beads shaped like hexagons, a rock flecked with silver, 3 red rubber bands in varying sizes and widths, a small bottle of hand sanitizer. Well, thanks, guys, Oliver said happily. Christmas dilemma officially solved, Jimmy L. announced. Oliver agreed as he shoved everything into his jacket pockets, gave high fives to his buddies, and headed back home. Those are the best friends I'll ever have, was Oliver's first thought. Then, this Biederman thing better work. I'll tell Issa about Benny this afternoon, Jessie promised herself. At the moment, Issa was in the dungeon practicing her violin, and Jessie was perched at the top of the basement stairs, a new experiment spread out before her. She was trying to make a fruit battery out of lemons, nails, wires, and pennies. Issa paused from her violin playing and looked up at Jessie. Are you going to electrocute yourself? Of course not. Jessie squinted at the object spread around her. Maybe. She shrugged, unconcerned. Why don't you work on that down here? Jessie fiddled with her wires. You know the probability of getting me down there is 0.01%, right? She replied. Come on, Jess, Issa said. We might be moving soon. I want to share this with you. Silence. Please, Jess. Don't you love me? She wheedled. Jessie sighed and stood up. Fine, but only because you identified my greatest weakness. Jessie inched down the stairs, glancing around as if waiting for something with venomous tentacles to drop on her head and inject poison into her bloodstream. When she got to the bottom, however, her fears vanished. Issa! Wow! She breathed. This is magical. I knew you would like it. Issa gloated. Issa's eyes followed Jessie as she walked slowly around the basement, running her fingers through thick, nubby carpets hung on the wall and gently touching delicate silver stars strung above. While Jessie took it all in, Issa began to play a tender Beethoven concerto, her violin ringing through the basement. Jessie felt the music go straight into her heart. Never had Jessie heard Issa's violin sound better, and she knew it was from the homemade acoustical treatment her sister had created in the basement over the years. Everything about this space breathed life and happiness and beauty. When Issa's piece ended, she lifted her bow off the strings, and Jessie watched her twin drift back to earth. Sounds pretty great down here, right? Issa said, grinning at Jessie. It's mind-blowing, Jessie admitted. Issa started wiping down her violin with a soft cloth she kept in her case. The violin actually belonged to Mr. Van Houten. It was a 3/4 size instrument that had been in his family for generations. With no one using it, he was lending it to Issa until she went up to a new size. At first, she hadn't even wanted to touch it. The wood was hundreds of years old. But when she had tried it, the sound was so pure and so lovely that she couldn't bear to let it go. It took me 6 years to get down here, Jesse said, ashamed. I'm sorry, Isa. Isa tilted her head. You don't have to be sorry. I'm glad you're here now. You put so much work into making this place beautiful. I didn't even help you. And now it's so perfect and your violin sounds so lovely. Hey, Isa said, you're always around when I need you. You've always stood up for me when it mattered. Remember Jefferson Jameson? Jesse remembered Jefferson Jameson, all right. Last spring, Isa had had a solo violin part in the school concert. Jesse had been heading backstage to wish her good luck before she performed, when she overheard Jefferson Jameson talking to someone. Jefferson was one of the cool eighth graders who never took off his Letterman jacket and always had a crowd of girls following him around. These concerts are so boring, Jefferson had said to a girl with long wispy hair and tiny ears. I wish they would cut the snooze music, especially that violin player. What's her name, Izzy? Jesse had been shocked. Snooze music indeed. Dvorak's Humoresque was one of the most beautiful pieces ever written. How dare he insult Dvorak and her sister? Jesse peeked around the curtain to see Isa looking stunned and uncertain. Jesse felt the telltale signs of her temper rising as hot blood rushed through her body. Jefferson and the girl were laughing when Jesse marched straight up to him and punched him in the arm, hard. Jefferson stumbled back. What the? You want to repeat that, jerk face? Jesse had said, jabbing her index finger in the middle of the big A on Jefferson's Letterman jacket. Jefferson was too dumbfounded to say anything to this tiny sixth grader with big black glasses and crazy hair getting in his face. You were talking about my sister, Jesse had said between gritted teeth, who just happens to be the most brilliant sixth grade violinist in the whole entire world. Maybe you smashed your head too many times on the football field, but even someone who has never heard quality music would know that Dvorak's Humoresque is a work of genius. I suggest you stop strutting around in that dumb-looking jacket and get some culture. Jesse had spun around, her backpack full of thick science books, smacking Jefferson in the ribs, and walked away. And another thing, Jesse had said over her shoulder to a slumping Jefferson, after my sister plays, I better see you applaud. I'm watching you. Isa had been called to the stage at that very moment. When she stepped into the spotlight, she looked confident and radiant. Then Isa lifted her violin and played Humoresque like she had never played it before. It was an unforgettable moment. Jesse shook off the memory and looked at Isa, who was now sitting on the carpet next to her. I never asked you how you felt after playing at that concert, Jesse said. It was amazing. This is going to sound crazy, but I felt your strength flow through me when I was playing. See, Jesse? You make me strong. Sometimes I think you know every thought that goes through my head. Jesse didn't respond. She wanted to believe that she was a good sister, but she couldn't shake the guilt about Benny. Isa, I have to... Do you think the brownstone loves us? Isa interrupted, so caught up in her own thoughts she didn't hear her sister. I do, she continued, wiping a tear from her eye. Jesse swallowed. Obviously, this was the wrong time to bring up Benny. Isa leaned back so she was lying in the middle of the carpet. Here, let me show you something. Lie down next to me. Jesse dropped down next to Isa, so they were head to foot. Listen, Isa said. What am I?
Shh!
Just listen. Jesse watched the stars glitter above her. She heard the pipes of the brownstone clinking lightly as they carried water inside and outside their home. Next to her, Isa breathed in and out in a steady rhythm. After a few minutes, Jesse almost felt as if she could hear the brownstone's heartbeat. And she knew, just knew, that if she could save Issa's basement, then the Benny thing would be okay, too. Chapter 14. When Oliver returned from the basketball game, he snuck past the kitchen where Mama was mixing away. The noise from the mixer's motor made it easy for him to race up the stairs without Mama noticing. Back in his bedroom, Oliver pulled on the arm warmers that Hyacinth had made for him and took out the donated gifts from his friends. He was delegating the red rubber bands to Lainey when his mom called to him from the kitchen. Oliver swept the gifts into his desk drawer, then grabbed his earphones and put them in, hoping that his mom would be too tired to climb the stairs in search for him. It was not to be. 20 seconds later, his mom opened the door and peeked inside. "Hey, you," she said. "Want to do me a favor?" Oliver sighed and removed the headphones. "Actually..." "Great," said Mama. She handed him an enormous basket of cookies, all packaged in clear cellophane with jaunty little tags. Every year, Mama made enough Christmas cookies to feed the entire population of Harlem. And ever since he could remember, she appointed him the distributor. "Mama, can't someone else do it? Whenever I pass your cookies out, people want me to come in and look at photos of their grandkids and talk to me forever." "That's why I included sustenance." Mama reached into the basket and pulled out a bag labeled Oliver. The bag contained all 6 kinds of cookies he liked best. Mama sure fought dirty when she wanted to. "All right. Go on now," Mama said. On her way out of his bedroom, she grabbed a stack of books off one of his shelves and put them into the empty moving box she had left in his room earlier that day. Then she disappeared out the door, and Oliver could hear her weaving around the growing number of boxes stacked against the hallway wall. Oliver put the books back on his bookshelf, shoved a few petition papers into his back pocket, and stumbled down the stairs with the enormous basket. "Have a fun time, honey," Mama called from the kitchen. Oliver grunted. He braced himself against the cold, then let himself outside. First stop, Mr. Smiley, the super at the building 2 doors down, and the father of Angie, his basketball buddy. Oliver staggered to the sidewalk and made his way over. "Oliver!" Oliver looked up to see Angie waving at him from the stoop of her building. She bounded down the steps like a gazelle and landed at his feet. He put his basket down and greeted her with their special basketball handshake, a complicated series of backhand slaps and finger pointing, ending with tilting their heads over their shoulders and saying, "Oh, yeah!" After that particular ritual was over, Oliver leaned down and pulled out the bag of cookies his mom had made for their family. "For you," Oliver said. Angie grabbed them and wasted no time opening the bag and removing a sugar cookie decorated like a Christmas tree. She took a bite and closed her eyes. "I love your mom's cookies," she said when she was done chewing. "Hey, can I come with you to drop the cookies off? We can get more signatures for your petition." Oliver nodded. "Sounds good. Hey, did I tell you that the Biedermans started showing the apartment to new people already?" Angie's eyes widened. "Don't you have tenant rights or something? My dad's always talking about tenant and landlord rights." "Mama says our lease is only good until the end of the year. He's allowed to rent to someone else if he wants." "There must be a way to stop him," Angie said, tapping her fingers against her chin. "Have you done an internet search on the Biederman yet?" Oliver nodded. "We tried, but our internet got shut off." "My dad will let us use his computer." Without waiting for Oliver to respond, Angie grabbed one of the 2 handles of the cookie basket, and together they lugged it to Angie's apartment. They opened the door to find her father, Mr. Smiley, sitting in his armchair, flipping through a dog-eared dictionary. "Are those Mrs. Vanderbeeker's holiday cookies?" Mr. Smiley asked, rising from his seat. Angie gave her dad the squinty eye before pulling the bag of cookies from her pocket and handing it over. "Don't eat them all," she warned. "Oliver and I are going to use the computer." She tossed her jacket onto an empty chair and sat down at the living room table, where an ancient monitor sat attached to a whirring hard drive. Oliver flopped into the seat next to her. "Does that thing even work? It looks a million years old." "It got a lot better after Jesse fiddled with it," Angie said, pulling up the internet search engine, which opened at once. Oliver didn't have time to be amazed at Jesse's apparent genius around computers, because Angie had already typed Biederman into the search function. They didn't know his first name, so they added Harlem and then City College. Angie scrolled and scanned, then punched more keys. Oliver watched the screen until his eyes glazed over. This was taking forever. "Hey," Oliver interrupted after what seemed like hours. "My mom will kill me if I don't deliver these cookies. You still in?" Angie took one last look at the search results, then reluctantly closed down the search engine. "I'll do more tonight," she promised before grabbing her coat and entering the living room. "Dad, I'm going to help Oliver with the cookie deliveries." Mr. Smiley, startled to see the kids, hastily stuffed an empty cellophane cookie bag behind the couch cushion before flashing them a guilty smile. A scattering of crumbs clung to his beard. Angie pointed an accusing finger at him. "Dad, you ate all of them?" When Mr. Smiley could only offer a sheepish shrug, Angie rolled her eyes and stomped out the door. Oliver followed her. He looked at his cookie bag and then at Angie. In an act of supreme sacrifice, he tapped her on the shoulder. When she turned around, he held the bag out to her. "You can have some of mine. I don't mind," he lied. "Really? Thanks." Angie took a cookie. It happened to be the one Oliver would have chosen to eat next, himself, and nibbled off an end. Oliver sighed. Sometimes it was just so hard to be nice. 2 hours later, the cookies were delivered, and Oliver had been grateful for Angie's company. It was exhausting, remembering his manners when talking to all those people. But Angie smiled and chatted as if she didn't mind seeing the same baby over and over in 2 dozen pictures. The cookie basket was empty save one bag, and they'd gathered 20 more signatures on the petition. Oliver gave Angie another cookie from his personal supply, leaving him with only 2. Oliver could not wait to go back home, sit alone in his bedroom, read Prince Caspian, and eat those last 2 cookies in peace. "If you want to leave those petition sheets for me, I'll get more people to sign," Angie offered. Oliver handed over the petitions, then walked back to the brownstone. He had one last bag to deliver, this time to someone in his own building. The label said, "Mr. Biederman," in his mom's swirly handwriting. Oliver trudged up to the 3rd floor. When he got there, he saw a bag of trash hanging on the handle of the Biederman's apartment. He knew his father came up to the 3rd floor a few times a week to collect the Biederman's garbage and bring it down to the building trash bins. Oliver unhooked the bag from the doorknob and left the bag of cookies in front of the door. Halfway down the stairs, Oliver turned around, climbed back up to the 3rd floor, and placed his own bag of cookies down next to the one he had just left there. "Peace offering," Oliver said out loud. There was no response from the other side of the door. Oliver didn't expect there would be, so he headed back downstairs. Something inside the garbage bag made a funny clinking sound, so naturally Oliver peeked in to see what it was. Scattered among the remains of frozen dinners were shards of a broken record. 2 days left for Operation Biederman, Isa said from her spot by the easel in the twins' room. We need to diversify our strategy. We got a bunch of signatures for the petitions, Jessie said as she fiddled with an old computer hard drive she had found on the curb. It's not enough, Isa said. She drew a diagram on the whiteboard and wrote Biederman strategy in big letters in the middle, then drew two arrows pointing outward. One arrow pointed to petition. At the end of the second arrow, she wrote acts of kindness. Can't we sabotage the people who want to rent our apartment? That's a lot more fun. I know the other nice things we did for him did not go as planned, Isa said. But the petition can only do so much. It tells the Biederman that people like us in the neighborhood. But it doesn't tell him why. We have to persuade him to like us. We need to appeal to his heart. Technically, it's the brain that processes emotion, not the heart, Jesse pointed out. You know what I mean, Isa replied. I left the little Christmas tree outside his door, Lainey said while sucking on a strand of her hair. Don't suck on your hair, Isa said, followed by, that was very sweet of you. And me and Oliver left him a record, a jazz record, Lainey added. Isa raised her eyebrows. A jazz record? Cool. Miss Josie said he liked jazz, Lainey said breezily. I can't believe I never thought to ask Miss Josie about him, Jesse said. Of course. They've lived here even longer than he has. Oliver was not about to share what he'd discovered inside the Biederman's trash and break Lainey's heart. Angie tried to search for him on the internet. He reported instead, but she didn't come up with anything yet. What is wrong with me? Jesse said to no one. I should have asked Angie if I could use their computer. I also gave him some of my cookies, Oliver said. The room stilled. You what? Isa whispered. Cookies. Some of the ones Mama made for me. Jesse spoke slowly. You gave the Biederman cookies from your own personal stash? Willingly? Not under duress. Wow, Hyacinth said in wonder. Francis' tail thumped on the floor. I'm so proud, Isa announced. Such sacrifice. Oliver's face turned red. Can we just keep going with the meeting? Hyacinth spoke up. Mr. Jones said the Biederman used to teach art at the Castle College. No, not art. She tilted her head, thinking. Art history. We should contact the art history department at City College, Isa said. Maybe someone knows him there. Art history sounds so boring, Oliver remarked. I think it sounds romantic, Isa said. I would love to know more about what life was like when Vincent van Gogh and Pablo Picasso lived. That's because you have an artist soul, Jesse said. The right hemisphere of your brain is very highly developed. Yeah, art history is boring to those of us with normal brains, Oliver chimed in. I like art, Lainey interrupted. I want to learn about it. Thank you, Isa said primly. I think we should go to the art history department, Isa repeated. Maybe tomorrow, when we go out with the petitions again. Lainey's face lit up. We get to go to the castle? The last time the Vanderbeekers went to the castle was for a spring fair their school was hosting with the college. Lainey was only 2 at the time, and to her disgust, she didn't remember anything about it. Sounds good to me, said Jesse. Great. Now, what I was going to say before we got sidetracked, Isa gave Oliver a pointed look, is that we need to give the Biederman a more personal look into who we are. How? Oliver asked suspiciously. I'm not giving up any more cookies if that's what you're thinking. We need to wow him with how great we are, said Isa, so he wouldn't be able to imagine anyone as awesome as us living here. I'm good at hugging people, Lainey announced. I can't see hugging the Biederman going well right now, said Jesse. Maybe you can draw him a picture of the brownstone, Isa suggested. Who doesn't love a picture drawn by a 4-year-old? Lainey's brow creased. I'm 4¾, she corrected Issa.
I can make him something sciency, offered Jesse. I'll write him a poem, Oliver said.
His sisters stared at him.
What?
Oliver said defensively.
Poetry's cool, okay?
I wonder if I should make him a CD of my violin playing, said Issa.
I'm so much better than I was 6 years ago. Hyacinth kept her head down, pretending to inspect Franz for fleas.
Don't forget, we need to continue collecting even more signatures, Issa reminded them.
It's a lot, but we can do it.
Oliver started humming the Star Wars theme song.
No obstacle is too big,
Issa continued as Oliver increased his humming volume.
No man too mean, Jesse added.
We are the Vanderbeekers, piped up Hyacinth as Oliver reached a crescendo in his song.
Let's save our home, declared Issa.
Monday, December 23rd. Chapter 15.
We're going for a walk,
Jesse announced to her mom.
Take Lainey with you, Mama called out from the kitchen. Please,
she added with a note of desperation. On every available inch of counter space and on every available inch of the kitchen floor lay Mama's baking supplies ready for packing. Lainey was having a wonderful time examining each item and organizing the supplies for her own personal store. She had found a stack of sticky notes and priced items anywhere from 1 cent to $300,000. Papa emerged from the bathroom, where he was sanding down the walls in preparation for a new coat of paint.
I think you officially have every baking utensil ever invented, Papa said, looking at the clutter of the kitchen.
He picked up a metal pincer thing with needle-like tips.
What is this?
It's a fondant crimper. Don't let Lainey have it, Mama replied, and she watched him hand it to Lainey.
Ooh, fun,
Lainey said, squeezing it together.
Please, Issa, save my life here, Mama pleaded.
Lainey, let's go for a walk,
Issa suggested, plucking the fondant crimper out of Lainey's hands and handing it back to Mama.
We could check out City College, Issa said in a sing-song voice as she took Lainey's coat off the coat hook and held it out to her.
Yay, the castle!
Lainey said, jumping to her feet. She looked at Mama.
We're going to find out if princesses live there, Issa cut in.
Okay, Mama said as she packed up the fondant crimper. She did not say, be careful, or be back in an hour or else. So the kids knew she was very distracted. A northeastern wind had joined the cold front, and it felt 20 degrees colder than the day before. Whenever a gust passed, the kids turned so their backs served as shields against the wind. No one spoke. Hats were pulled low, and scarves were pulled high. The smell of Castleman's bakery tempted the Vanderbeekers when they passed by, and each Vanderbeeker felt noble as they resisted the desire to take shelter in the cozy store. They crossed the street and stood before the college entrance. Imposing wrought iron gates reached skyward, and beyond the gates was the college campus. Up close, the buildings were more intimidating than they were from the brownstone roof. Instead of being like a princess's home, the buildings looked like they belonged on a craggy cliff above a raging sea during a lightning storm. The Vanderbeekers looked at each other. Finally, Issa shrugged and stepped inside the gates. Her siblings followed her down a cobblestone path toward the center of campus. When they emerged in the enormous courtyard, they found the college almost deserted.
Wow, said Oliver. Where are the people?
I think this college is closed, Hyacinth said. I'm sure people are still working,
Issa said in her falsely cheery voice.
There must be a map somewhere.
I see it! I see a map,
Lainey said. She dragged Issa by the hand to an information post.
Look, they have a whole department just for chemistry, Jesse said reverently, looking over Lainey's shoulder as she examined the map. That's awesome!
And a music department, too, Issa said.
Let me see, said Oliver, crowding in.
Ah, here it is, the art history department. It's in Gothel's Hall.
Issa looked away from the map and surveyed the campus.
That one.
To Lainey's disappointment, Gothel's Hall wasn't the huge castle building visible from the Vanderbeekers' brownstone roof. Instead, it was like a miniature version of the more impressive castle. The kids made their way to the building, and it took the strength of both Oliver and Jesse to push the heavy wooden doors open wide enough for the rest of the kids to squeeze inside. The black iron hinges groaned. The temperature inside was only slightly warmer than outside, and the interior seemed to be made entirely of cold marble. Marble floors, marble walls, and before them, a long marble staircase. The kids wandered around, lost for 10 minutes, before they ran into a student in plaid flannel pajama bottoms and boots that looked like house slippers.
Do you know where the art history department is? Jesse asked him.
The guy pointed.
2 floors up. Make a right. The office is at the end of the hall.
The kids followed his directions, and sure enough, a door at the end of the second floor hallway had a piece of paper with art history written on it in fat marker. Issa peeked in. A woman with graying hair pulled into a severe bun sat behind a wooden desk that took up nearly the whole room. The top of the desk was completely empty, except for a shallow box filled with papers in one corner and a desktop computer in the other.
Just put it in the box,
she said in a monotone voice, not looking up from her computer. Tap, tap, tap. Issa stepped into the room.
I'm sorry to be a bother, but I just have one quick question.
You're about to be late with your paper. Either turn it in now or fail the class, she replied.
Tap, tap, tap.
But I'm not in a class, Issa replied. I have a question about someone who might have worked here.
Finally, the woman looked at the Vanderbeekers.
Kids are not supposed to be here, she said, her pencil-thin eyebrows raising up to her hairline.
We have a question, Issa repeated slowly. We were wondering if you know of a Mr. Biederman. He used to work in this department.
Never heard of him, the woman replied, going back to her computer.
Where are your parents? Tap, tap, tap.
We are doing research on our neighbor, Jesse chimed in, stepping inside the office, followed by Oliver, Hyacinth, and Lainey.
He might have worked here 6 years ago.
I told you, I never heard of him. And I've worked here for 5 years.
Tap, tap, tap.
Is there anyone who would have been here 6 or 7 years ago who might know?
Issa pressed.
Nope, faculty left last week. Final papers are due right now, and in 10 seconds I'm packing these essays up and mailing them off to Professor Suarez's home. The college will be closed until January 15th. You can come back then.
Tap, tap, tap.
January 15th? Jesse exclaimed. You can't look it up on your computer right now?
The lady stopped tapping and powered down her computer.
Sorry.
She did not sound one bit sorry. The Vanderbeekers watched as she slid the papers from her desk into a manila envelope. From the hallway, the Vanderbeekers heard someone yell,
Wait! I have it!
The kids peeked out the door and saw a disheveled girl racing toward them, waving a paper. When the girl reached them, she grabbed hold of the doorway to stop her momentum. The Vanderbeekers parted to let her inside.
I have my paper, she gasped.
Too late, the gray-haired lady replied.
She pointed at the clock. It was 10:01 a.m.
The girl clutched her heart. Please, I have to pass this class or I'll lose my scholarship.
Everyone out of my office, the ruiner of hopes replied. My winter break started 1 minute ago.
The lady grabbed her jacket and purse from the coat rack, then pushed everyone out of the office and into the hallway. She followed them and closed the door behind her. After she locked it, she took a last look at the dejected group of people around her. To Issa and Jesse, she said, "Come back in January, after the 15th. Maybe someone can help you then." To the girl with the paper, who was now wringing her hands and crying, the gray-haired woman snapped, "Next time, don't be late." Then she yanked the essay out of the student's hand and clicked down the hallway, disappearing around a corner. "Oh, thank goodness," the frazzled student said, slumping down against the wall. The Vanderbeekers shook their heads in wonder. College was looking more and more like a place where dreams came to die.
"There are no princesses here," Lainey said, tears leaking out of her eyes as she followed her siblings out of the building.
"Oh, Lainey, I'm sorry. This was my terrible idea," Issa said, picking Lainey up and drying her little sister's eyes.
"Do you want to go to Castleman's? I'll buy you a cookie."
Lainey shook her head, her hair tumbling into her face.
"I want to go home."
The Vanderbeekers began to trudge back to 141st Street, all illusions about the magic of the Castle College lost forever. They yearned for the warmth of their home, the pets awaiting their arrival, the comfort of Mama's nourishing meals, and the love of their friends and neighbors. It was a quiet walk back to 141st Street. When they arrived at their block, Jesse paused to get a signature for the petition from their neighbor Charlotte and her son Joseph. While 5-year-old Joseph carefully inscribed his name on a line, a middle-aged man in a worn overcoat and swathed in a bright red scarf approached them.
"Want to sign our petition?" asked Lainey, approaching him and unearthing another crumpled petition from her coat pocket.
The man's eyes crinkled kindly as he looked at the 5 kids standing before him. He took the paper and unfolded it.
"Hello," the man said in a deep, gravelly voice. "Tell me about your petition."
The kids introduced themselves.
"We're trying to convince our landlord to renew our lease," Issa explained.
"Surely,"
he said, signing Mr. Austin Rochester on an open line without bothering to read the top.
"I applaud your civic-mindedness," said Mr. Rochester.
A blast of arctic wind came through, and Mr. Rochester and the kids turned their backs to it. When the wind eased, he continued,
"I love seeing people get involved in their community. I always try to encourage that in my work."
"Where do you work?" asked Hyacinth.
"I'm a musician," said Mr. Rochester. "I play the cello and I conduct an orchestra for teens called Rhythm NYC.
"I've heard of that," said Issa, her eyes brightening. "I'm a musician, too. I play the violin."
"If you're in high school, you can audition," encouraged Mr. Rochester.
"I'm only 12. But in 2 years, I'm totally going to audition. It sounds amazing."
Mr. Rochester reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a business card.
"Keep this, and be sure to audition the summer before your freshman year. All the information is on our website."
Issa cradled the business card as if it were a priceless gift.
"Do you live around here?"
asked Oliver.
"No, but I'm looking at an apartment in this area. It's in a brownstone."
He showed Oliver the address.
"Am I going in the right direction?"
Issa, Jesse, Hyacinth, and Lainey watched Oliver read the address, then glance up at them with panicked eyes.
Actually, you need to go 3 avenue blocks that way."
Oliver lied, pointing in the opposite direction.
"Thank you very much. I have the worst sense of direction. My wife is always leading me everywhere. She's traveling in Egypt right now, doing research on mummies." "Cool, right?"
"Cool," echoed the children.
"Well, I better get going. I have a rehearsal right after I see the apartment, and I'm already running late," he said, looking at his watch. "It was very nice meeting you all."
Mr. Rochester shook all the kids' hands, accepted a hug from Lainey, then strode away from them and the brownstone.
"Lightning might strike me down right here," said Oliver.
"He was so nice," Issa said with tears in her eyes. "And we just lied to him."
"It was for a good reason," Jesse said weakly.
"I want him to be our neighbor," declared Lainey. "His wife knows about mummies."
"He would have been perfect for the brownstone," Issa said mournfully. "He would have understood the spirit of it."
A particularly brutal wind swept through, and the Vanderbeekers didn't bother turning their backs to avoid the sting on their cheeks. It felt like a well-deserved punishment.
Chapter 16.
Later that afternoon, the siblings worked on their acts of kindness projects. Lainey sat at the living room table making her brownstone drawing, with Hyacinth, Jesse, and Oliver next to her. Franz lay under the table, keeping an eye out for Paganini, who had taken to drinking from his water bowl. Downstairs in the basement, Issa was recording her violin CD. After 10 minutes of silent work, Hyacinth looked over at Lainey's progress.
"Is that supposed to be our home?"
Hyacinth asked.
"Yup," said Lainey, the tip of her tongue sticking out the side of her mouth.
Jesse peeked over from where she was working on her fruit battery experiment.
"Our brownstone is not rainbow-colored."
"Nope," said Lainey, adding a violet stripe in the middle of the building.
"The Biederman won't even know what that is," scoffed Oliver.
"Sure he will. It's the brownstone."
"Don't you think it should be more realistic?" Jesse suggested.
"Here, let me help. I'm doing it my way," Lainey said, pushing Jesse's hand away. Lainey pursed her lips in a stubborn line as she continued her drawing. Soon the entire page filled with color. Along the bottom she had drawn her family, including the animals, Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet, and what she thought the Biederman looked like. Hyacinth didn't want to reveal her real plan for the Biederman. It was top secret. So instead, she made a Christmas wreath with cardboard and tissue paper. As she glued small puffs of rolled-up tissue paper onto a cardboard circle, a thought came to her.
"Why do you think the Biederman never leaves his apartment?"
Jesse shrugged.
"He's a crabby old man who hates everyone."
"That doesn't make sense. We know other crabby people who leave their apartments."
"Mr. Nelson is super-duper crabby," Lainey reported, thinking about the guy who manned the booth at their local subway station. "It's 'cause he has arithmetic."
There was a brief pause.
"Arthritis," Jesse corrected her.
"Does the Biederman have that, too?"
"There has to be a bigger reason for not ever leaving your apartment," Oliver said. "Maybe he's on house arrest," he suggested, his eyes brightening. "Or maybe he's in the witness protection program."
"Uncle Arthur needs to stop sending you mysteries," Jesse said.
Oliver ignored her and waved a piece of paper in the air. Hyacinth had given him stationery with drawings of pandas all over it for his poem, which Oliver thought was weird, but his sisters insisted was cute.
"Hey, how does this haiku sound? I haven't bounced my basketball in 40 days. Do you feel the peace? The great commander, Oliver S. Vanderbeeker."
"It's a little
brief," Jesse said, as she sifted through a box of odds and ends she had picked up over the years. Bolts, bent nails, tubing, rusting pennies, and orphaned keys were all jumbled together.
Oliver rolled his eyes.
"Hello, it's a haiku. 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables.
He signed it with a flourish. Meanwhile, Jesse gathered 4 lemons and 6 pieces of wire that were connected on each side to small alligator clips. She clipped the wires to the lemons by attaching one end to a nail on one lemon and the other end to a penny on the next lemon. Pretty soon,
All four lemons were connected, and the wires on the ends dangled free. Jessie looked at her siblings.
"Are you ready?" she asked.
They nodded eagerly. Jessie touched the remaining wires to two small prongs coming down from an LED light, and the light blinked on.
"Wow, wow, wow!"
Lainey yelled, reaching out to touch it. Jessie swatted her hand away.
"That's so cool," Hyacinth said. "The Biederman will be amazed."
"Is that all it does?" Oliver asked, unimpressed.
"I'm going to stick this cool bead on it." Jessie nudged a translucent, emerald green bead onto the LED light so it glowed prettily.
"Ooh, I love that," Hyacinth said. "I want one too," Lainey said.
"Is that all it does?" Oliver asked again.
Jessie shrugged. The effect was less dramatic than she would have liked. If she'd had time, she would have created a more elaborate lighting situation with dozens of lemons and more lights. But scientific progress couldn't be achieved without experimentation, and hopefully the Biederman would recognize and appreciate the effort. Jessie took one prong off the nail of one lemon so as not to waste valuable citric acids, then laid her project out on a tray, and they brought their gifts upstairs. Oliver stayed back with Hyacinth on the second floor, since she was still traumatized from the placemat disaster. Lainey's drawing and Oliver's poem were shoved under the door. Hyacinth's wreath was taped up under the peephole, and Jessie settled her tray on the floor. Then she slipped another note under the door. It read, "Check outside and be surprised." As Hyacinth watched her sisters set everything up, she only hoped she could be brave enough to go to the Biederman's door, too, when the time was right. The doorbell rang a few minutes after the kids returned. Franz sprinted toward the door, not realizing that the rug by the door had been packed up. He skidded against the wood floor and slammed into the wall. Jessie nudged him aside.
"Hey, Angie,"
Jessie said, opening the door and letting her in. Franz recovered after a brisk shake and circled Angie, his tail registering 200 WPM.
"Is Oliver here?"
Angie asked, unwrapping her scarf and scratching Franz behind the ears.
"Yup,"
Jessie yelled behind her.
"Oliver, the girl who kicks your butt at basketball's here."
Oliver came out of the kitchen with a thick peanut butter and jelly sandwich in his hand.
"Hey, what's up?"
he said, around a mouthful of sticky sandwich. Angie looked up at him with solemn eyes.
"I found out something about the Biederman."
Oliver stopped chewing. Jessie ran to the basement stairs and yelled for Issa, who was still recording her CD. Soon, all the Vanderbeeker kids surrounded Angie.
Oliver swallowed. "What is it? What did you find out?"
Angie handed Oliver a sheet of paper. It was a computer printout with a few brief lines of text. Oliver read it out loud.
"Abigail Biederman, 42, and daughter Luciana, 16, Harlem residents, died on March 8th, 2007. They are survived by husband and father Arthur Biederman. Arrangements under the direction of Bernard's funeral home."
He looked at Angie.
"Do you think this Arthur Biederman is our Biederman?" "I'm almost positive this is your Biederman. My dad recognized the first name."
"He had a kid and a wife?" Issa asked.
"It can't be him," Jessie said. "He hates kids. He hates people." "What if he..."
Oliver paused dramatically.
"Killed them."
Hyacinth gasped. Franz growled. Lainey stuck her pinkies in her ears.
"If he killed them," Jessie pointed out, "he would be in jail."
"Only if they found him," Angie chimed in. "Maybe that's why he never comes out of his apartment. He's hiding."
"No, no, no," Issa said. "He wouldn't be hiding where he lived. He would be on some remote island off the coast of Mexico or Madagascar or something."
"True,"
Oliver admitted, looking back down at the obituary. His eyes kept focusing on the word, died. It seemed so final.
I wonder how they died, Jesse said. Strange that his wife and daughter died, but he didn't.
Isn't that so sad? Issa asked. Can you imagine if we all died and only Papa was left? What would Papa do?
Papa would cry, Lainey said. He would cry and cry and cry.
The kids fell silent, imagining what it would be like to have your family die and be the only one left living. Issa had a black hole feeling in her stomach. It was only 3 o'clock, and nothing was going right. First, the failure to get in touch with the art history department at City College. Then the whole lying to a super nice person for selfish reasons situation with Mr. Rochester. Finally, most of all, discovering that the Biedermans' family was dead. Her mind was a tornado of thoughts and questions and anxiety while she recorded herself playing the violin section of Paganini's Cantabile for violin and guitar for the CD she was making for the Biedermann.
It's hard to play a cantabile when your mind is a tornado, Issa thought, and she started over again.
Jesse joined her in the basement not too much later. As Issa recorded her fourth take, she watched Jesse prop two pillows against the wall and sprawl against them with her National Geographic magazine. A few minutes later, she watched Jesse slowly close her eyes, lulled to sleep by the violin playing and the warm air wrapping around her from the radiator. Issa switched off the recorder. There was no magic in the cantabile right now. She needed to get outside, breathe fresh air, and clear her mind. She glanced at Jesse, wondering if she should wake her. But her sister looked so peaceful, curled up on the carpet. Issa laid a blanket over her before heading upstairs. Issa made her way to Castleman's to buy bread for the next day's dinner, fighting the intensifying wind the whole way. She was anxious about seeing Benny again after their super weird conversation a couple of days ago. Benny was one of her best friends. She had spent hundreds of hours in the bakery with him, playing board games and working out puzzles. More recently, Benny was the boy who helped her find her locker and walked her to classes on the first day of middle school. How could he care so little about their move? By the time she arrived at the bakery, Issa was surprised to feel her heart pounding. She entered to find Mrs. Castleman, not Benny, behind the register, helping another family with an order. Issa hung back and studied the glass case, even though she knew everything in it with her eyes closed. When the other customers left, Mrs. Castleman spotted Issa and gestured her over.
"I have something for you," Mrs. Castleman said, reaching under the counter and pulling out an envelope.
"Read it later."
"What is it?" said Issa, taking the envelope.
It was so light, Issa wasn't sure anything was inside. Mrs. Castleman just shook her head and disappeared through the doors into the back of the bakery. Issa froze when she heard Mrs. Castleman calling Benny to come out and handle the front. Issa busied herself by putting the envelope in her bag, her hands trembling. When the doors swung open, Issa looked up. Benny saw her, stilled, then stiffened.
"Hi," Issa said.
"Hi," Benny replied.
"I'm here to buy bread."
"Fine.
I'll take 3 loaves of French bread."
"Fine." Benny took 3 loaves from the basket and bagged them. "That's $4.50. Issa took out her wallet and gave him exact change.
"Thanks," Issa said.
Benny didn't respond, turning his back to her as he adjusted the display of breads hanging in wire baskets against the wall. Issa took the bag and started to leave, but she was feeling reckless, an unusual emotion for her. She turned back around and stomped to the cash register.
"What exactly is your problem, Benny?" Issa demanded, hands on her hips.
Benny spun around. What do you mean, my problem? How can you even ask that? You're the one with the problem.
I have a problem? You're the one acting so weird. A terrible thing is happening to me, and you don't even care.
Benny's eyes narrowed.
Nice to know I'm such a terrible thing. Thanks a lot, Isa.
What does this have to do with you? I thought you would help me not blow me off.
Me blow you off? You're the one who...
Benny stopped and took a deep breath. Look, Isa, let's just pretend this whole thing never happened, okay?
What thing? You're making no sense.
Are you telling me you forgot about the eighth grade dance already?
What does the eighth grade dance have to do with me? I helped Allegra choose a dress for the dance. If that's what you're talking about, she's going with Carlson.
I know she's going with Carlson, Benny said through gritted teeth. I'm talking about you.
I'm not going to the dance, Benny. No one asked me, Isa said, her voice rising to a shout.
I asked you, Benny shouted back. Then silence.
What, with you?
Isa stuttered.
You never asked.
I did. I asked Jessie if she thought you would go with me, and she said you would definitely not. She was positive.
Isa's heart skipped a beat. Then she whispered, she never told me, Benny.
Right, Benny said bitterly. You two talk about everything.
Don't act like you didn't know.
Anyway, I've already asked someone else. Benny began to tidy up the area around the register, dismissing her. Isa felt like crying. How could he think she was lying to him? Did he really want to take her to his dance? Who was he taking now? And then there was Jessie, her best friend, her twin sister, the person who knew her better than anyone, or so she thought. Isa left the bakery and blindly walked toward home, not feeling the harsh wind whipping around her. She needed to get answers. She needed to talk to Jessie. Chapter 17. Mama was exasperated. Mr. Biederman's real estate agent had the nerve to call about someone seeing the place tomorrow. Tomorrow, Christmas Eve. Mama said absolutely, definitely no apartment showings on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. When the agent continued to wheedle her, Mama hung up on her. The nerve. I have too much to do, Mama said, talking to herself as she stood in the middle of a living room full of boxes. Oliver was sitting inside one box reading, and Lainey was sitting in another, pretending she was a puppy.
I can help you,
Hyacinth offered from her spot on the rug. Her brow was furrowed as she manipulated knitting needles, and Franz's eyes were glued to the unwinding yarn ball. Mama glanced at the grimy basset hound.
You know, you can help. Franz needs a bath.
It had been 3 weeks since Franz's last bath. The longer Franz went without a bath, the wilder and more erratic his behavior became. He was much more contained when he had clean ears and smelled like honeysuckle. With the swiftness of hunted gazelles, Oliver and Lainey jumped out of their boxes and raced up the stairs. Their disappearances were phenomenons that happened every time Hyacinth gave Franz a bath. Hyacinth eyed her dog.
Don't worry, Franz.
This will be quick. Franz hunkered down by the back door and tried to make himself invisible. Hyacinth lured him with her secret weapon, a dog biscuit, and Franz's stomach betrayed him as he crept toward the heavenly-smelling treat. Hyacinth grabbed his collar at the same time Franz grabbed the biscuit, and she used all her strength to drag him toward the bathroom and into the tub. 15 minutes later, Franz was hoarse from his persistent howling, and they were both soaked. Hyacinth wrapped Franz in a fluffy towel, then braced herself, and knocked on the bathroom door 3 times.
Are you ready? Hyacinth yelled. Not yet. Wait.
Okay, I think everything is secure, her mother yelled back. Hyacinth opened the door a crack and peeked out. Her mom had put up an old baby gate to block the stairs leading up to the bedrooms, and Paganini had been removed to safety upstairs.